Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. Being against sexism is all the rage, and like most things a person can be against, it's not as easy as it sounds. With sex and gender, we have all these sneaky little assumptions, inherited attitudes, a great deal of personal experience, not to mention scientific research, to mess with our best efforts at gender fairness. We might want to be gender neutral, but of all the things human beings notice about each other, gender is way up there. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll look more closely into the assumptions we commonly make about gender to see how they affect the way we act and feel, especially toward each other as men, women, and whatever. Our guest is Cynthia Eller, who describes herself as an apparently textbook case woman. She's also assistant professor of women and religion at Montclair State University and author of several books, including The Myth of Matriarchal Prehistory and Living in the Lap of the Goddess. Her new book is entitled Am I a Woman? A Skeptic's Guide to Gender, recently published by the Beacon Press. In the book, Cynthia Eller pulls the various strands by which we give meaning to gender and consciously does something most of us do subconsciously, taking measure of herself based on our understanding of gender conventions. If this all sounds very academic, maybe politically correct, and maybe even a bit circular, well, that's something we like to do sometimes on this show. It's part of our franchise. Besides, it just might lead to some insights, and we hope that'll happen during this hour. As we talk with Cynthia Eller, you are invited into the conversation. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the web, anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. And Cynthia Eller joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning, Professor Eller.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You say the question, am I a woman, is a personal, painful one for women. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure it is for every woman. I think that, you know, there's a variety of how taken for granted people's femininity is. And I think most women don't actually pose it as, am I a woman? But they do ask questions regarding to whether or not they're feminine enough, whether or not they're functioning properly in their female-specific roles, whether they have the right sort of feelings or attitudes or behaviors that they've been taught that women are supposed to have.
The right things, how do we know that? How do we know what the right feelings and attitudes are?
Oh, I think you hear it all the time. I mean, there's just constant comments. I'm especially aware of it now as I watch my daughters grow up, how often they're told what's correct and incorrect behavior for girls or for boys, you know, just flat out, not to mention all of the things that you just read in from watching how men and women behave and how men and women talk about other people who they don't think are behaving correctly for their gender. You know, from everything as casual as seeing someone on the street and saying, what's that? You know, if it's not immediately apparent if it's a man or a woman.
Right.
To, you know, you can't wear your hair like that if you're a girl, or, you know, really minor examples like that.
And one of the first things kids always want to know about, you know, people or especially animals. You see an animal, kids see an animal, and ask, is it a boy or a girl?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the implication that is really important.
Yeah, I think it's really important to us. I don't know that it would be really important to human beings wherever they are, but it's certainly one of the first things that boys and girls focus in on.
Mm-hmm. The question you ask, am I a woman, implies asking another question. What is a woman, which you say is profoundly political?
Mm-hmm.
In what sense is it? I guess I'm asking, what are the political implications of gender?
Well, so much of what we believe that we can do politically or not is based on what we think women and men actually need, what their desires are, how they're different from one another.
Yeah.
And a lot of legislation occurs along sex-specific lines. So that's just even in the more narrow, you know, legal definition of political. But then just in terms of human relations generally, people's presuppositions about men and women are enormously influential in what you're able to do and what you're able to do without reproach from other people. I really think that sexism, because there are these fairly obvious differences and people feel comfortable talking about how different men and women are just in casual conversation, that attention is drawn away from the fact that it really is just another garden variety form of prejudice. And if you want to know why it's profoundly political to ask what is a woman, you know, just ask, you know, is it profoundly political to know what does it mean to be black?
Mm-hmm.
That's a profoundly political question.
Mm-hmm.
What puts you in one category rather than the other? What do we decide about people based on their being in that category or not? And the same is true, only perhaps even more so with gender.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what puts you in one category or another. There, you write about the difference between sex and gender, which, you know, I think there's a fairly lively debate about that, you know, if there is a difference. But, if people outside the academic debate might say, well, it's obvious, sex defines gender.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think to a large extent sex defines gender, but not necessarily in the way we think. I think the sort of knee-jerk response is that sex defines gender because you look at people and their bodies are different, and you can tell which they are, and knowing that their bodies are different, you can also expect that their emotions are different and that their brains will function differently and so on. And you think you know rather a lot about a person once you have, you know, looked at them with your eyes and decided which sex class they belong in. I think it is really more complex than that. I think that the sex you are is, in fact, based on the one you appear to be, but has more to do with what people project onto you once they have decided that you belong in one sex class or the other.
Mm-hmm. So gender defined by physiology, well, even there, if we take that as a yardstick or a measure, you're right that that's not as clear as we might think at first glance, that there are variations on the polar extremes that mm-hmm. kind of throw the whole thing into question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there absolutely are. I mean, I think physical sex is important because it's how people decide who you are and what they can expect from you. But physical sex is not, completely male and female. There's a lot of variations in between. And people, I mean, if you just sort of look at it at the intuitive level, there's so much that human bodies have in common, male and female human bodies. I mean, our stomachs are pretty much the same, for example. Our knees are pretty much the same. You could go on and on. I mean, we share a great deal more physically than we don't share. And even on those attributes that are sex differentiated, there's a sliding scale. I mean, there are all sorts of people who don't fit neatly into one category or the other. You know, men who have breasts and, true hermaphrodites, people who have an XY chromosome and yet they look female from their appearance. And the number of people who fall into what's called that intersex category may be as high as like 5 or 6% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting story about Bruce and Brenda Reimer that kind of, I mean, this whole issue of, you know, is it a physically defined gender or is it something that somebody can learn through the way they're raised or the culture around them and so forth. And I wonder if you could, talk about that story and maybe what you draw from that.
Uh-huh. The case of Bruce Reimer, he grew up in Canada, and he had an identical twin brother. And they were both circumcised when they were babies, not right after they were born, but soon thereafter. And Bruce's circumcision was a medical disaster, and they ended up destroying his penis. And so the decision was made at some point, the parents made this decision after they saw a movie on the television, actually, about gender identity. The decision was made to raise Bruce as a girl. And the theory was that if he was raised as a girl from this young age, he would never know anything different, and that gender didn't really have anything to do with physical sex. So he would just become a girl and never feel different or behave different or really look different from other girls. And so he was raised as a girl. He went to regular therapy sessions with Dr. John Money, who was one of the most famous gender identity doctors in the world, actually.
Right.
And then when he got to be a teenager, he didn't adjust very well to being female when he was younger. And when he got to be a teenager, his family finally told him that he had been born male. And he decided to become male, and so he stopped taking estrogen supplements and renamed himself David and is now a happily married man living in Canada.
That's very interesting.
With a surgically crafted penis.
Yeah.
And, of course, people have taken all sorts of morals from this story, and
right.
I think the most obvious one is to say, well, then gender really is biological, you know, that even after he had been raised as a girl and had been treated as a girl, it still wasn't enough to quiet, you know, this inner male in him that was being driven along by his testosterone or by his XY chromosomes or whatever it was. But we also have so many cases of people who are very obviously male who always believe that they're female,
right,
and eventually have themselves changed over surgically. So, it's not entirely clear. And, of course, there's complicating factors in the case of Bruce Reimer. He had an identical twin brother. a person in his house who looked exactly like him, except he was a boy.
Well, then there are other people that sort of seem to disprove the idea that even if, say, you're a man who feels like a woman, that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to have sex with other men.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's even distinct from sexual preference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, there are some rather well-known cases of transsexual men, male-to-female transsexuals, who are now lesbians. They were only ever interested in having sex with women, and when they became women, they were still interested in having sex with women. So, yeah, there's no clear correlation there.
Well, there seems to be a lot of interest in finding correlations, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it upsets people that there are these things that don't fit into the neat categories. And I think it's because we have so much invested in the whole idea of gender. It's very hard for us to see, you know, odd cases, things that trouble us. In the same way that, you know, in a very racist society, people are troubled by, you know, interracial couples or interracial children.
Well, this is the question that I find very interesting. Is it really sexism to feel that you have a need to define somebody's gender? I mean, we seem to have this need. There's a sort of innate sort of thing that says, well, you know, you look at somebody and one of the first things you notice is, are they a man or a woman? I mean, mm-hmm. Why is that so important?
Well, I don't know how innate it is. We haven't done the experiments to find out how much that's just hardwired into us, you know, as part of our courting behaviors, and how much that has to do that we live in a society that's strongly sexually differentiated, where everybody you see on TV, you know, you don't have a hard time figuring out whether they're men or women.
Right.
And it's not just the way that they look. It's the way they're dressed. Mm-hmm. It's the way that they're made up. It's the lines that they're given to say. That all go to put together these packages of femaleness and maleness. So I don't think we have a real good sense of how much we would care about gender if we were in a society that cared a lot less.
It's hard to do a controlled experiment.
Oh, yes, it's very difficult. But I'm all for doing an uncontrolled experiment. I'd like to try a generation or two of being a little bit looser around this and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you know, throughout the book, I think it's really interesting that you take all these ways that we measure gender and you compare that to how, you know, you perceive yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that you make very clear that, you know, it's not been a source of great, you know, like dysfunction or anything for yourself,
mm-hmm.
but that you've never felt comfortable with the sort of definitions that have been imposed upon you as a woman.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure how much anybody feels comfortable with it. I think it's partly a question of how conscious you are or aren't of the process in which you're made into one gender or the other. But I think it's really quite natural to feel that there's some kind of disjunction between the person society is asking you to be and the person that you feel yourself to be. And sex is one of the most obvious places where that happens, since some of the most obvious expectations are being put on you there. But, I mean, I think it's part of the human experience more generally, not just in terms of sex.
Mm-hmm. And those expectations, I mean, I guess this is somewhat, you know, getting down to the root of it, that when we try to figure out where those expectations come from, a lot of people basically say, well, that's just human nature. That's the way we are. We will have those expectations because that's the way nature made us.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this debate, well, no, that's the culture that teaches that, so it's not nature, it's nurture.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that it's probably some of both.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's some of both, but there's so much variation cross-culturally
mm-hmm.
in what people's expectations are for genders that maybe the fact of us needing to distinguish between men and women and, you know, the fact of us making those two social classes and putting expectations into them is pretty natural for human beings because
mm-hmm.
we're sexually dimorphic, because we come in two sexes. But the actual details, the content, is so malleable that you can't really take seriously, you know, arguments that very strenuously say, well, this is just how men are everywhere you find them, and this is just how women are. So it's not that we're training people into these roles. This is what they naturally manifest as a result of, you know, their biochemistry.
Right. Well, and it certainly impacts people. I found it really, your section in the chapter about body hair for women
mm-hmm.
and how that makes people feel. I mean, women are not expected to have body hair.
Right.
But the ironic thing is that most women have body hair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent example of sort of picking apart that difference between biology and culture. Because biologically, I don't think there's really no question. Women having body hair is a biological fact, and it's what people choose to do with it culturally. And what they've chosen to do is to say that women aren't supposed to have it, even though we do. So, I mean, that's a pretty clear example of a place where culture is trumping biology.
It's sort of even almost a taboo topic to talk about, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know if I can talk about it on the air. It's
sure you can. This is public radio. We do that kind of thing.
Well, have you ever felt uncomfortable being a man, or felt that you weren't filling the male role properly?
Only in the sense that I'm not 6'2" and I don't play football.
Mm-hmm. Were those ever issues for you when you were younger, and it seemed like there was an expectation for you to be a certain kind of person?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a pretty universal experience.
Well, I think that's right.
And I don't think we need to put it on ourselves nearly as much as we do. And, I think in your case probably, and in mine, it wasn't that severe or disabling. But certainly there are many, many stories of people for whom it was.
Well, I think, your section on feelings and emotion also play into that. That, mm-hmm. I think men are as affected by the stereotypical conception of what they're supposed to be like as women. Maybe the implications aren't the same for men as they are for women. But, this whole idea that, we could talk about this, the stereotype, women are supposed to be emotional, empathetic, social. They make connections. They bridge with other people. Men are analytical, selfish, and that's okay.
They live on their own island.
Right.
Their own emotionless island.
Yeah, and that plays out in any number of ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and you have whole pop cultures based on a theory like that. The whole, men are from Mars, women are from Venus phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
All built on those stereotypes. And those stereotypes, people have tried to test for them. I mean, psychologists have tried to do the very best tests they can to see if those differences actually show up in male and female populations. And here we're talking about male and female populations that have been raised as men and women their whole lives. I mean, we're not talking about, infants that were brought up in a completely non-gendered way to see if these differences manifest themselves. Even people who've been trained to be, very relational and nurturing and empathic on the one hand, or to be very analytical and cold and selfish on the other, these differences don't show up reliably. And they don't show up convincingly. They're not big differences between men and women on these things. And yet you have a phenomenon like the Mars-Venus phenomenon that, people talk all the time about how it's saved their marriage, or it's made them, finally understand their partner.
Right.
What do you suppose is behind that?
Well, we have a caller to talk with. Let's let's include them in our conversation.
Okay.
I want to mention again that we're talking with Cynthia Eller. She's a professor of women and religion at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Her latest book is Am I a Woman? A Skeptic's Guide to Gender. That's what we're talking about. If you'd like to join our conversation, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I have not read this book. This is a disclaimer. It's one I want to read. I have one question about death and dying. Has any research been done on how people die? That's a question to your guest, and I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Well?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
No.
Is differentially men and women how they die?
The caller has hung up, and I'm not sure that we're talking about the same thing here.
Yeah.
So we can just, maybe we'll just move on.
Okay.
You mentioned something that made me think about how we raise our children, and you write about your own. You have two daughters,
mm-hmm.
and I think that I have a daughter and a son, and we try to be enlightened parents and not impose particular gender stereotypes on our children as we raise them, but I'm not sure that we can really successfully do that very well. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Oh, I don't think you can successfully do that. First, you have the question of whether or not there really are any, irrefractable biological sexual differences that you can't address. But, you're not all of society when you're a parent. You're
right.
A tiny fragment of it. And, when your children are busily getting this barrage of information about gender from their peers, who, at some point they find much more convincing than you anyway, I really don't think, you can help them question it. You can help them think about it.
Right.
You can tell them that their value doesn't lie in how well they're being male or female. But, you know, I don't think that there's any way to try to raise gender-free children. It has been my experience, though, that parents who have both male and female children, especially one of each, tend to be more convinced of how deeply rooted sex differences are than parents who have two or more children of the same sex. And, I mean, I think there's kind of an obvious reason for that, is if you have a couple of children of the same sex, you're all the time noticing how very different they are, and you can't blame it on their sex. Whereas with children of different sexes, it's much easier to see that as the explanation.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. In our case, our daughter, you know, is, you know, there are a lot of characteristics she has that one, you know, our culture associates with girls, and our boy definitely is, you know, he's mechanically inclined. He's very left-brained, as we used to say.
Uh-huh.
You know, and my wife and I go, well, my God, did we do that to them?
It's entirely possible that they came that way. And, of course, it's entirely possible that they came that way for reasons having nothing to do with their biological sex.
That's right.
That they were just temperamentally inclined that way, and it, you know, could have as easily gone the other direction. I'm always impressed, too, with how much people will notice certain things that fulfill their gender expectations but not notice things that don't fulfill their gender expectations.
Yeah.
One of my favorite examples for this is, this was some years ago when Mira Sorvino won the Academy Award for Best Actress. And I watched this on the TV, and she was accepting the award, and she was very happy, but, you know, pretty cool and together. And her father, Paul Sorvino, an actor, is out in the audience crying his eyes out. And the next day on the radio, I heard two separate commentators on the awards talk about how Mira Sorvino looked at her father, and she cried and cried. She saw her father, and she talked about him in the speech, and she started crying, and he was sitting there beaming and proud.
But that's not what happened.
No, and the footage is there to show it. The footage is there to show that he was crying and she was not. But the way people remember that event is based on how they think it should have been. They think she should have been crying because she's the woman, and he should not have been crying because he's the man.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We have a couple of the calls to include in our conversation. We'll go next to someone in Danville on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, sir. Nice talk to you. I was wondering if the guest was familiar with a writer by the name of J.T. Leroy.
No, I'm not.
Well, he's one who's come to recent acclaim. He's a person who was born to a heroin-addicted mother who was a prostitute and who allowed him to be abused at an early age. And he spent his time between her and his fundamentalist grandparents. And he's recently has some writings out about that experience, which he wrote when he was 16 years old after he'd taught himself to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find him on, you can Google him right up on the web, and it's a very interesting topic. I wonder if you could maybe speak around that type of situation in your conversation there.
Well?
And his, subsequent identity crisis that he now is living with, you know, at an age of the early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Does this have
What does his identity crisis revolve around?
Well, whether he's a man or a woman.
Uh-huh.
You know, his mother would dress him up as a little girl.
Oh, I see.
And allow her abusive boyfriends and the Johns to abuse him when he was a very young age, and then he later become a male prostitute plying the caravans or the truck stops.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and his subsequent, you know, coming to understand his own identity and stuff and how he turned that into a writing career now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really, I guess he's got quite a following in Hollywood. He's not, I'm sure, a real popular model around the Midwest, but he's got quite a following. His writings are kind of shocking, you know, when you realize they're written by a 16-year-old, his first short stories and stuff. But he has one being made into a movie now. It's called Sarah, The Heart is Above All Things Deceitful, I believe is the name of it.
Uh-huh.
And it's very, very interesting reading. I think it really ties in with what you're talking about there, Dave.
Oh, yeah, I think it does. That sounds fascinating.
Maybe if you can just comment on that type of a situation and how that comes into play. I mean, how biology versus environment, of course, you know, plays into the whole thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's all I've got to comment on. I'll listen to what you have to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know if, is that...
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the particulars of that case, but I mean, it does sound to me like a good example for how different the experiences of boys and girls are. And you take somebody who has been sort of on both sides of the fence, during his childhood because he was put there. You know, he has interesting things to say about, you know, what it's like to be female and what it's like to be male, and, you know, what it's like to try to reconcile people treating you one way or the other in your own sense of yourself. Mm.
Okay. Well, we got another caller waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I don't know how widespread this phenomenon is, but something I've noticed recently that's taking place in Champaign that you may have noticed other way places, and just dealing, you know, this idea of sex roles, what you think traditionally. There are a couple of bars here in town that are promoting amateur boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, it's campus, it's completely women boxing each other, and the other, another part of town, it's men against men and women against women.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I think boxing is a bad thing, especially considering the kind of head trauma that can take place, but that aside, what do you have to say about this phenomenon of you know, promoting more aggressive activity on the part of women, taking on more traditional male sort of roles in that kind of venue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are experiments sort of going on in both directions, experiments with women taking on more of what's traditionally masculine. And you could make an argument that popular culture in general over the past 20 years has moved in a more aggressive and violent direction associated with men, but now, you know, considered appropriate behavior for girls and women as well. I'm not too sure about that. You know, there are definitely experiments in the other direction. You know, men who are giving themselves permission to behave in ways they think of as more feminine. Certainly men are allowed a lot more physical vanity than they were allowed 20 years ago. Men are supposed to care about how their tattoos and their earrings look, even if they're not, you know, spending quite as much time on their hair as women are.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Well, you know, I've noticed this too in the past few years, and I don't know whether it's just, you know, a fashion trend or, you know, something in popular culture that's driving this, maybe what people are watching on television, but it does seem that there's a resurgence of these sort of extreme, like, gender fashions that, you know, the especially in the college age people, that the women are really, you know, wearing lots of makeup and you know, mm-hmm. You know, very sexy women kind of clothes, and men are also like the tattoos and
mm-hmm.
you know, muscle shirts, and really accentuating.
They're going for more butch look.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is something that. I don't know where it's coming
from. I think there are countervailing trends. I mean, I think that there's sort of experimenting on both sides of the gender
mm-hmm.
divide, but there
mm-hmm.
there is a lot of reinforcement of the basic idea of, you know, how women dress and how men dress and how you're supposed to look if you're a woman and how you're supposed to look if you're a man. Oddly enough, I think some women really buy themselves a lot of freedom by dressing like women
uh-huh.
and making themselves up like women, that if they're doing a good enough job of appearing the way that women are supposed to appear, then they can actually get away with not acting the way women are supposed to act. I mean, even in their own families, I have students who come from very conservative homes, and as long as they're dressing in a very female way, their family doesn't seem to notice that they're going to college and that they're pursuing a career
uh-huh.
and that they intend to keep that career in place. So, I mean, it can cut a lot of different ways, I think, that sort of very stereotypical manner of self-presentation.
We're talking this morning with Cynthia Eller. She's professor of women and religion at Montclair State University in New Jersey. We're talking about her latest book, Am I a Woman? A Skeptic's Guide to Gender, recently published by The Beacon Press. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have about 20 minutes left. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. One of the other issues you raise is how we're supposed to act as men and women, and how this has sort of always been problematic. You find yourself forcing yourself to act like a woman when you wouldn't otherwise act that way.
Mm-hmm. Less so now than I used to. And I really do think it's just because I've had more practice now.
Yeah.
It comes more naturally to me. It's kind of like riding a bike. again, I think that this is probably something that most people deal with on one level or another, whether they're, you know, very conscious of it or not. You know, but they have a reaction to some event, and they realize it's not the gender-appropriate reaction, and so they substitute the one that is. I mean, maybe they see the roadkill on the street, and their first thought is, oh, that's interesting. What is that thing hanging out of its guts? And then they think, oops, I'm a woman, and they go, ew, or vice versa. You know, a guy looks at the roadkill, and he thinks, that's totally disgusting, and he wants to look away, but he knows he's not supposed to, so he looks at it and makes some comment about the guts spilling out or something.
And what's the penalty for not acting appropriately?
I think the penalties are really quite severe. I mean, not on one little individual instance like that, but across the board, if you don't do a good job of presenting the gender that people expect you to present, you know, the punishment can range from just sort of being ostracized and thought of as an oddball to, you know, there are plenty of people who have been killed, you know, as a result of presenting the wrong gender. You know, people think they're dealing with a man, they find out it's a woman, and they're outraged that they've been fooled like this. And, you know, people have been murdered for less than that, but that's certainly, you know, it's getting beaten and murdered is considered a pretty serious threat in the transgender and transsexual communities where, you know, where you have people that are very obviously crossing those lines.
A couple of the calls to talk with. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I just was wondering if your guest thinks that, I mean, I've heard people say that they think the pursuit of happiness or part, a really large part of the pursuit of happiness is being with people, being able to be with people who think, you know, have the same values and live among people who have the same values as you do. And therefore, one of the reasons, you know, and if one of your values is, for example, value that women should not be particularly hairy, you know, how do you, or are you aware that I mean, you've said before that people are uncomfortable, but in fact, that you are actually making people unhappy by, you know, trying to disrupt this wonderful neighborhood, quote unquote.
Yeah, I think that's probably a better statement of it than I made. It's just there's, you know, so much rejection from the subtle to the obvious of people making it clear that they don't want to see these things that don't fit in with their picture of how things should be.
But how do you? I mean, I actually am not very disturbed by too much. I kind of like diversity, but this is like a core value for a lot of conservative types, and there's a lot of them around here. And I don't really know how to counter that, you know, because they think it's you know, almost a right to pursue that kind of world.
That kind of homogeneity.
Yeah. So, how do you? I mean, do you have any suggestions on how to do that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to be a missionary to that particular population, but I am struck by the fact that even people who are quite conservative about gender roles are acutely aware of the fact that people don't always fit them naturally. I was reading a book by a Christian evangelical woman writing about motherhood, and she was talking about the importance of raising your girls and your sons differently, and saying that girls needed to be loved and sons need to be respected, and girls need to be raised to become mothers and wives, and boys needed to be raised to become, you know, God-fearing, responsible men who would be the heads of their families. And, you know, she talked quite obviously about how, you know, this needed to happen because the sexes are different. And she kept saying, you know, we're raising them to go with the grain rather than against it. But then she said, you know, you may have a daughter who's a tomboy and you shouldn't tolerate this. Your job is to teach her to be feminine and to like it. So, you know, everyone knows that there is some teaching involved, that, it's not all a question of coming naturally. I guess, you know, it's a different thing to try to convince people who believe that these things are natural that perhaps they're not. than to try to convince somebody who believes that they're not necessarily natural, but that things are better that way if we all behave that way. And maybe that's sort of the position that you're referring to, you know, more conservative idea that, that people, you know, if they are not sort of mainstream gendered, they should at least make themselves look that way so that they don't make other people uncomfortable.
One last thought. You were talking about Myra Sorvino and crying. And within the last couple of months or so, I believe it was, I was listening to this talk show out of Washington, the Diane Rehm show. And she was interviewing somebody who was a transsexual. And I'm forgetting the details, but the one thing that I do recall is that she said that the one thing that was a real shock to him when he started taking estrogen is that he would cry at the drop of a hat. And you know, it took a lot of getting used to. So there's that hormone angle.
I'm sure that all of these biological angles play in. The problem is that they're not that determinative. You know, it's not the case that everybody who's given estrogen or everybody who produces it naturally cries at the drop of a hat, and people who don't. I mean, if you go out and find men, and I'm sure that you've met some men who are like natural criers. You know, they cry at the movies, they cry when they're happy, they cry when they're sad. My guess is you're not going to, if you go and draw their blood, you won't find that they are all, you know, producing way too much estrogen. So, you know, while you can say, yeah, that estrogen does seem to have this effect on the emotions, it's not, you know, a completely A plus B equals C sort of equation.
Is that also true for particularly sports-minded and aggressive women, too, that if you draw their blood, you won't get a lot
you
of...
You won't find that they're all surging with testosterone, yeah. There aren't real tight correlations on these things the research that's been done.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, see, that's interesting because, you know, when someone does find a high level of estrogen in a man who cries easily or testosterone in a woman who's, you know, particularly athletic, they go, aha, well, this proves, you know, this shows.
But in the studies that are done more carefully that are looking to be disprove as much as to prove what they're talking about, they're generally not that successful in proving it when it comes to sex difference. There's just a lot of variability, and it's not well explained, you know, solely by the kind of physiological markers that we usually think of around gender.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we have a couple of the callers. Let's get on next to a listener in Wilmington on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Several years ago, I kind of went on a personal crusade to use the word women or woman when I'm talking about someone who's of age, just like we do with men. They like to be called men instead of boys. And yet I think that people get the impression when I say that woman or there was a woman that they think of someone 65 or over. And we're supposed to be flattered if they call us girls like we haven't grown up.
Right.
And if you call... African American boy, that's an insult.
Yeah.
And also, someone says that someone is a real woman, that has a sexual connotation. But if he's a real man, that means he's brave and courageous.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of asymmetries in language that really do a lot to uncover what our deeper thoughts are about sexual stereotypes. And certainly the difference between the way woman and man are used is a very good example of that.
Well, I don't know how good I'm doing with my personal crusade, but I'm trying to do it.
Well, I hope you stick with it. I personally don't want to be considered a girl anymore at my advanced age. I like to think that women should be proud of growing up and growing wise.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 8 minutes left with Cynthia Eller talking about her book, Am I a Woman? A Skeptic's Guide to Gender. One caller waiting. Time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, anywhere outside of Champaign-Urbana, 800-222-9455. Another Champaign listener next on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll try again. I called first, and I'll stay on the line. I had four boys, four sons. We had four sons. My question was, has any research been on death and dying? For example, do men die more easily than women? I have not read your book. So this is a question to Cynthia and also to you, Jake. I'm intrigued by this concept. All my life I've spent in this issue. So I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Do you understand the question?
Oh, don't hang up. I want to ask you about the question.
Okay.
So you're interested in the actual process of dying, or
if men die more often
than women? Or
no, I'm actually interested if any research has been done on this topic.
Mm-hmm. On the question of how they experience death?
Yes, yes.
I'm not aware of any research that's been done on that. Now, have you had any experience with it? Or
I have clinically, but I have not done research.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm intrigued by this issue.
What are your clinical observations?
My clinical observations are that men are strong. Women are also sometimes strong. It doesn't matter the sex. But my clinical observations, we have had many more women than men in our program.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wondered if there had been any research done on this thing, because I'm very, very interested, and also professionally,
mm-hmm.
and I just wondered if it has been researched.
No, I'm not aware of that, no.
Okay, that was my question.
Okay, well, thank you very much for persisting.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Well, a couple other callers, and I want to make sure we include them. So we'll go next to a listener in Pena on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. It just occurred to me in listening to the program that when we talk about sexual things, we begin to make generalities. And I just made a list of variables when we try to make decisions about such things. Childhood, schools, parents, relatives, family, community, genetics, rural or city, small town, level of education, religion, age, attitude, the society, the economy, economics, physical makeup. That's just to name a few when we end up making some generalities about this thing of how we have gone to a certain sexual proclivity.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my comment.
Mm-hmm.
Many,
mm-hmm.
many variables.
Yeah, that's an impressive list you've made up there.
Thank you.
And I think it's a good thing to keep in mind that, you know, we don't like things that are too complicated. We want them to be simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And since biological sex is something that we can usually readily identify when we see people on the street, we may not be accurate about which sex they are, but we can generally tell which sex they want us to think they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from there we're willing to draw all sorts of conclusions, because it's a lot easier than going into the much more complicated picture of looking at people as individuals. And yet the price of not looking at people as individuals, it's prejudice, it's bias, it's sexism, it's racism, in every case it's the same basic problem of, putting people into categories, and then when they don't seem to fit, just stuffing a little harder.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. One of the reasons this really matters is, you know, when we apply those sort of gender yardsticks to people and say, I think that no matter what you think about what those gender definitions are, if we say we're for social equality, economic opportunity, and, you know, the rights of each individual to be judged on their own merits, we only have to look at the economic numbers to see that women still are not treated equal to men.
Right, right.
And I think that's often missed in this whole debate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, people often, I think especially now, since a number of large gains were made by the feminist movement beginning in the 1970s, you know, people like to talk about it being a post-feminist age and about sexism being, you know, more invisible and more a matter of, you know, subtle attitudes and whatnot, but it's right there in the numbers. It's, there are a lot of just very hard realities that make it clear that we're not anywhere close to a sexual egalitarianism.
One more caller we'll include in our conversation. This is an Urbana listener on line number three. Good morning.
Yes, good morning all. Jack, you've been doing a great job. You have a more musical voice than David does. David's job is in trouble. Cynthia.
Oh, no, no, no.
I'm staying out of this.
yes, you must, Cynthia. But since you have to answer the big political question here, well, I know time's short, and I'll just ask it and hang up. To what extent does sexism tie into what we are now considering the culture wars, and of course the political ramifications are, you know, just humongo. I'll let you go. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'm going to need a little more enlightenment on the culture wars. What are we talking about specifically here?
Oh, well, I'm not exactly sure what the caller means by the culture wars. I can imagine a number of things that, you know, that pertain. I mean, I think that right now especially we seem to be undergoing a kind of ferment about what kind of culture this is, what kind of government we want, you know, whether it's, you know, a free market versus, you know, social welfare or some kind of, you know, safety net kind of situation, and what the basic nature of human beings is in relation to, you know, their political systems and their culture. That probably doesn't say it very well, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think it's clear that sexism would tie in here pretty prominently. Because it's yet another idea about who people naturally are and what people need to flourish. That may or may not be backed up by evidence. And, you know, even if it's not backed up by evidence, a lot of people are, you know, I think we talked about this a bit earlier in the program, too. They're just very uncomfortable with anything that doesn't fit their picture of the way things ought to be, and it's very easy for them to find, you know, incidents that confirm what they want to believe and to ignore other ones. So, you know, any system like this, any set of stereotypes, in this case, sexist ones, or, you know, in the case of other culture wars, you know, whatever they may be pertaining to the economy or politics or whatever, there's just a lot of power of inertia behind them. You know, it's things that people are comfortable with and that they've come to believe, and, you know, trying to break out of them is difficult regardless of what the, you know, reality is behind it, regardless of what it really does take for human health and flourishing. Anything that's a threat to the way things are now is going to be, it's going to have an uphill battle.
Well, we're here at the end of our time, so we're going to have to leave it there. There's much more in the book, and it's actually a very entertaining read, I must say.
Thank you.
It looks like it was a lot of fun to write.
Oh, it was. I had a great time writing it.
That's great. Well, the book, again, entitled Am I a Woman? A Skeptic's Guide to Gender. And the author is our guest, Cynthia Eller, E-L-L-E-R. The book is recently published in hardcover by the Beacon Press. So if you would like to take a look at that, I'm sure you can find it in bookstores and libraries. And Cynthia Eller, I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Oh, thank you.
All right.